This is Audible.
Infinite Jest. Written by David Foster Wallace. What happened was that by the third week of his freshman year, Orrin was attempting an extremely unlikely defection from college tennis to college football. The reason, he gave his parents, Avril made it clear that the very last thing she wanted was to have any of her children feel they had to justify or explain to her any sort of abruptly or even bizarrely sudden major decision they might happen to make. And it's not clear that the mad stork had even nailed down the fact that Orrin was still in Metro Boston at BU in the first place. But Orrin still felt the move demanded some kind of explanation. Was that fall tennis practice had started, and he discovered that he was an empty, withered, psychic husk, competitively burned out. Orrin had been playing, eating, sleeping, and excreting competitive tennis since his racket was bigger than he was. He said he realized he had, at 18, become exactly as fine a tennis player as he was ever destined to be. The prospect of further improvement, a crucial carrot that Stitt and the ETA staff were expert at dangling, had disappeared at a fourth-rate tennis program whose coach had a poster of Bill Tilden in his office and offered critique on the level of bend your knees and watch the ball. This was all actually true, the burnout part, and totally swallowable as far as the from tennis part went. But Orrin had a harder time explaining the decisions to football component, partly because he had only the vaguest understanding of U.S. football's rules, tactics, and non-metric venue. He had, in fact, never once even touched a real, pebbled leather football before, and, like most serious tennis players, had always found the misshapen ball's schizoid bounces disorienting and upsetting to look at. In fact, the decision had very little to do with football at all, or with the reason Orrin ended up starting to give before Avril all but demanded that he stop feeling in any way pressured or compelled to do anything more than ask for their utter and unqualified support of whatever actions he felt his personal happiness required. Which is what she did when he started a slightly lyrical thing about the crash of pads and sis-boom-ba of pep squad and ambiance of male bonding and smell of dewy turf at Nickerson Field at dawn, when he showed up to watch the sprinklers come on and turn the lemon wedge of risen sun into plumed rainbows of refraction. The refracting sprinklers part was actually true, and that he liked it. The rest had been fiction. The real football reason, in all its inevitable real reason banality, was that, over the course of weeks of dawns of watching the auto sprinklers and the pep squad, which really did practice at dawn, practices, Orrin had developed a horrible, schoolboy-grade crush, complete with dilated pupils and weak knees, for a certain big-haired sophomore baton twirler he watched twirl and strut from a distance through the diffracted spectrum of the plumed sprinklers, all the way across the field's dewy turf. A twirler who'd attended a few of the all-athletic team mixers Orrin and his strabismic BU doubles partner had gone to, and who danced the same way she twirled and invoked mass pep, which is to say, in a way that seemed to turn everything solid in Orrin's body watery and distant and oddly refracted. Orrin in Candenza, who, like many children of raging alcoholics and OCD sufferers, had internal addictive sexuality issues, had already drawn idle little sideways eights on the post-coital flanks of a dozen BU co-eds. But this was different. He'd been smitten before, but not decapitated. He lay on his bed in the autumn PMs during the tennis coach's required nap time, squeezing a tennis ball and talking for hours about this twirling, sprinkler-obscured sophomore, while his doubles partner lay way on the other side of the huge bed, looking simultaneously at Orrin and the New England leaves changing color in the trees outside the window. The schoolboy epithet they'd made to refer to Orrin's twirler was PGOAT, for the prettiest girl of all time. It wasn't the entire attraction, but she really was almost grotesquely lovely. She made the moms look like the sort of piece of fruit you think you want to take out of the bin, but then, once you're right there over the bin, you put back because from close up you can see a much fresher and less preserved-seeming piece of fruit elsewhere in the bin. The twirler was so pretty that not even the senior BU football terriers could summon the saliva to speak to her and athletic mixers. In fact, she was almost universally shunned. The twirler induced in heterosexual males what UHID later told her was termed the Acteon complex, which is a kind of deep, phylogenic fear of transhuman beauty. About all Oren's double's partner, who as a strabismic was something of an expert on female unattainability, felt he could do, was warn O that this was the kind of hideously attractive girl you just knew in advance did not associate with normal, collegiate human males, and clearly attended BU athletic social functions only out of a sort of bland scientific interest, while she waited for the cleft-chinned, ascopartic male model-looking, wildly successful in business adult male she doubtless was involved with to telephone her from the back seat of his green stretch Infinity, etc. No major sport player had ever even orbited in close enough to hear the elisions and apical lapses of a mid-southern accent in her oddly flat but resonant voice that sounded like someone enunciating very carefully inside a soundproof enclosure. When she danced at dances, it was with other cheerleaders and twirlers and pep squad terrierettes, because no male had the grit or spit to ask her. Oren himself couldn't get closer than 4 meters at parties, because he suddenly couldn't figure out where to put the stresses in the Charles Tavis unwittingly inspired, "Describe the sort of man you find attractive, and I'll affect the demeanor of that sort of man," strategic opening that would work so well on other BU subjects. It took 3 hearings for him to figure out that her name wasn't Joel. The big hair was red gold, and the skin peachy-tinged pale, and arms freckled, and zygomatics indescribable, and her eyes an extra-natural, high-definition green. He wouldn't learn till later that the almost pungently clean, line-dried laundry scent that hung about her was a special low-pH dandelion adder decocted special by her chemist daddy in Shiny Prize, Kentucky. Boston University's tennis team, needless to say, had neither cheerleaders nor baton-twirling pep squads, which were reserved for major and large crowd sports. This is pretty understandable. The tennis coach took Oren's decision hard, and Oren had had to hand him a Kleenex and stand there for several minutes under the poster of an avuncular Big Bill Tilden, standing there in World War II-era long white pants and ruffling a ball boy's hair. Oren watching the Kleenex sogify and get holes blown through it, while he tried to articulate just what he meant by burned out and withered husk and carrot. The coach had kept asking if this meant Oren's mother wouldn't be coming down to watch practice anymore. Oren's now former doubles partner, a strabismic and faggy sweatered but basically decent guy, who also happened to be heir to the Nickerson Farms meat facsimile fortune, had his cleft-chinned and solidly BU-connected dad make a couple quick calls from the back seat of his forest green Lexus. Boston University's head football coach, the Boss Terrier, an exiled Oklahoman who really did wear a gray crewneck sweatshirt with a whistle on a string, was intrigued by the size of the left forearm and hand extended impolitely but not intriguingly during introductions. This was Oren's tennis arm, roughly churn-sized. The other, whose dimensions were human, was hidden under a sport coat draped strategically over the aspiring walk-on's right shoulder. But you can't play U.S. football with a draped sport coat, and Oren's only real speed was in tiny 3-meter lateral bursts. And then it turned out that the idea of actually making direct physical contact with an opponent was so deeply ingrained as alien and horrific The Dorans' tryouts, even at reserve positions, were too pathetic to describe. He was called a dragass, and then a mollygag, and then a bona fide pussy. He was finally told that he seemed to have some kind of empty swinging sack where his balls ought to be, and that if he wanted to keep his scholarship, he might ought to stick to minor-type sports, where what you hit didn't up and hit you back. The coach finally actually grabbed Oren's face mask and pointed to the mouth of the field's southern tunnel. Oren walked south off the field, solo and disconsolate, helmet under his little right arm, with not even a wistful glance back at the pep squad's PGOAT, practicing baton aloft splits in a heart-renderingly distant way beneath the visitors' northern goalposts. What Metro Boston AAs are trite but correct about is that both Destiny's Kisses and its dope slaps illustrate an individual person's basic personal powerlessness over the really meaningful events in his life.
100.
That is, almost nothing important that ever happens to you happens because you engineer it. Destiny has no beeper. Destiny always leans trench-coated out of an alley with some sort of psst that you usually can't even hear because you're in such a rush to or from something important you've tried to engineer. The Destiny great event that happened to Oren Incandenza at this point was that just as he was passing glumly under the home goalposts and entering the shadow of the south exit tunnels at it, a loud and ominously orthopedic cracking sound, plus then shrieking, issued from somewhere on the field behind him. What had happened was that Boston University's best defensive tackle, a 180-kilo future pro who had no teeth and liked to color, practicing special teams punt rushes, not only blocked BU's varsity punter's kick, but committed a serious mental error and kept coming and crashed into the little padless guy while the punter's cleated foot was still up over his head, falling on him in a beefy heap and snapping everything from femur to tarsus in the punter's leg with a dreadful, high-caliber snap. Two pep majorettes and a water boy fainted from the sound of the punter's screams alone. The blocked punt's ball caromed hard off the defensive tackle's helmet and bounced, crazily, and rolled untended all the way back to the shadow of the south tunnel, where Oren had turned to watch the punter writhe, and the lineman rise with a finger in his mouth and a guilty expression. The defensive line coach disconnected his headset and dashed out and began blowing his whistle at the lineman at extremely close range, over and over, as the huge tackle started to cry and hit himself in the forehead with the heel of his hand. Since nobody else was close, Oren picked up the blocked punt's ball, which the head coach was gesturing impatiently for from his position at the midfield bench. Oren held the football, which he'd not been very good at during tryouts, holding on to it, feeling its weird oval weight, and looked way upfield at the stretcher bearers, and punter, and assistants, and coach. It was too far to try to throw, and there was just no way Oren was making another solo walk up the sideline and then back off the field again under the distant green gaze of the twirler, who owned his CNS. Oren, before that seminal moment, had never tried to kick any sort of ball before in his whole life, was the unengineered and kind of vulnerable revelation that ended up moving Joel Van Dyne way more than status or hang time. But as of that moment, as whistles fell from lips and people pointed, and under that same green and sprinkler-hazed gaze, Oren found for himself, within competitive U.S. football, a new niche and carrot. A show-type career he could never have dreamed of trying to engineer. Within days he was punting 60 yards without a rush, practicing solo on an outside field with a special teams assistant, a dreaming Gaulois-smoking man who invoked ideas of sky and flight and called Oren Ephib, which a discreet phone call to his youngest brother revealed not to be the insult Oren had feared it sounded like. By the second week, O was up to around 65 yards, still without a snap or rush, his rhythm clean and faultless, his concentration on the transaction between one foot and one leather egg almost frighteningly total. Nor by the third week was he much distracted by the 10 crazed, pituitary giants bearing down as he took the snap and stepped forward, the gasps and crunching and meaty splats of interpersonal contact around him, the coolly typed shuffle of the stretcher-bearers who came and went after the whistle blows. He'd been taken aside and the empty scrotum crack apologized for, and it had been explained, complete with blow-ups of rulebook pages, that regulations against direct physical contact with the punter were draconian, enforced by the threat of massive yardage and loss of possession. The rifle shot sounds of the ex-punter's now useless leg were one in a million sounds, he was assured. The head coach let Oren overhear him telling the defense that any man misfortunate enough to impact the team's new stellar punt man might could just keep on walking after the play was over, all the way to the South Tunnel and the stadium exit and the nearest transportation to some other institution of learning and ball. It was, pretty obviously, the start of football season. Chris Bear, everything half-dead, burning leaves, hot chocolate, raccoon coats, and halftime twirling in something called the wave. Crowds exponentially larger and more demonstrative than tennis tournament crowds. Home versus SUNY Buffalo. Home versus Syracuse at Boston College, at Rhode Island. Home versus the despised Minutemen of UMass Amherst. Oren's average reached 69 yards per kick and was still improving. His eyes fixed on the twin inducements of a gleaming baton and a massive developmental carrot he hadn't felt since age 14. He punted the football better and better as his motion, a dancerly combination of moves and weight transfers, every bit as complex and precise as a kick serve, got more instinctive, and he found his hamstrings and adductors loosening through constant and high-impact competitive punting. His left cleat finishing at 90 degrees to the turf, knee to his nose, rocket kicking in the midst of crowd noise so rabid and entire it seemed to remove stadium's air, the one huge, wordless, orgasmic voice rising and creating a vacuum that sucked the ball after it into the sky, the leather egg receding as it climbed in a perfect spiral, seeming to chase the very crowd roar it had produced. By Halloween, his control was even better than his distance. It wasn't by accident that the special teams assistant described it as touch. Consider that a football field is basically just a grass tennis court, tugged unnaturally long, and that white lines at complex right angles still define tactics and movement, the very possibility of play. And that Oren Incandenza, who, tennis historically, had had mediocre passing shots, had been indicted by Stitt for depending way too often on the lob he developed as compensation. Like the equally weak passing eschaton prodigy Michael Pemulis after him, Oren's whole limited game had been built around a preternatural lob, which of course a lob is just a higher-than-opponent parabola that ideally lands just shy of the area of play's rear boundary and is hard to retrieve and return. Gerhard Stitt and DeLint and their depressing prorectors had had to sit eating butterless popcorn through only one cartridge of one BU game to understand how Oren had found his major sport niche. Oren was still just only lobbing, Stitt observed, illustrating with the pointer and a multiple replayed fourth down. But now with the leg instead. The only punting, and now with 10 armored and testosterone-flushed factota to deal with, whatever return an opponent could muster. Stitt posited that Oren had stumbled by accident on a way, in this grotesquely physical and territorial U.S. game, to legitimate the same dependency on the one shot of lob that had kept him from developing the courage to develop his weaker areas, which this unwillingness to risk the temporary failure and weakness for long-term gain had been the real herbicide on the carrot of Oren Incandenza's tennis. Puberty schmuberty, as the real reason for burning down the inside fire for tennis, Stitt knew. Stitt's remarks were nodded vigorously at and largely ignored in the viewing room. Stitt later told DeLint. He had several very bad feelings about Oren's future inside. But so, by freshman Halloween, Oren was regularly placing his punts inside the opponent's 20, spinning the ball off his cleat's laces so it either hit and squiggled outside the white sideline and out of play, or else landed on its point and bounced straight up and seemed to squat in the air, hovering and spinning, waiting for some downfield terrier to kill it just by touching. The special teams assistant told Oren that these were historically called coffin corner kicks, and that Oren Incandenza was the best natural coffin corner man he'd lived to see. You almost had to smile. Oren's full-ride scholarship was renewed under the aegis of a brutaler but way more popular North American sport than competitive tennis. This was after the second home game, around the time that a certain actionizingly pretty baton twirler, invoking mass pep during breaks in the action, seemed to begin somehow directing her glittering sideline routines and Oren in particular. So, and then, the only really cardiac-grade romantic relationship of Oren's life took bilateral root at a distance during games, without one exchanged personal phoneme, a love communicated across grassy expanses, against stadium's monovocal roar, entirely through stylized repetitive motions. His functional, hers celebratory, their respective little dances of devotion to the spectacle they were both, in their different roles, trying to make as entertaining as possible. But so the point was that the accuracy came after the distance. In his first couple games, Oren had approached his fourth down task as one of simply kicking the ball out of sight and past hope of return. The dreamy special team assistant said this was a punter's natural pattern of growth and development. Your raw force tends to precede your control. In his initial home start, wearing a padless uniform that didn't fit and a wide receiver's number, he was summoned when Boston University's first drive stalled on the 40 of a Syracuse team that had no idea it was in its last season of representing an American university. A side issue. College sport analysts would later use the game to contrast the beginning and end of different eras, but a side issue. Oren had a booked long of 73 yards that day and an average hang of 8-point-something seconds. But that first official punt exhilarated. The carrot, the PGOAT, the monovocal roar of a major sport crowd. He sent over the head of the orangeman back waiting to receive it, over the goalposts and the safety nets behind the goalposts, over the first three sections of seats, and into the lap of an emeritus theology prof in row 52 who'd needed opera glasses to make out the play itself. It went in the books at 40 yards, that baptismal competitive punt. It was really almost a 90-yard punt, and had the sort of hang time the special teams assistant said you could have tender and sensitive intercourse during. The sound of the podiatric impact had silenced a major sport crowd, and a retired United States Marine Corps flyer, who always came with petroleum jelly samples he hawked to the knuckle-chapped crowds in the Nickerson stands, told his cronies in a Brookline watering hole after the game that this Incandenza kid's first public punt had sounded just the way Rolling Thunder's big-bellied Bertha's had sounded. The exaggerated whoomp of incendiary tonnage, way larger than life. After 4 weeks, Oren's success at kicking big, egg-shaped balls was way past anything he'd accomplished hitting little round ones. Granted, the tennis and eschaton hadn't hurt. But it wasn't all athletic, this affinity for the public punt. It wasn't all just high-level competitive training and high-pressure experience transported intersport. He told Joelle Van Dyne, she of the accent and baton and brain-locking beauty, told her in the course of an increasingly revealing conversation, after kind of amazingly she had approached him at a Columbus Day major sport function and asked him to autograph a squishy-sided football he'd kicked a hole through in practice. The deflated bladder had landed in the marching terrier's sousaphone player's sousaphone, and had been handed over to Joel after extrication by the Lardy tubist, sweaty and dumb, under the girl's acteonizingly imploring gaze. Asked him, Oren, now also suddenly damp and blank on anything attractive to say or recite, asked him, in an emptily resonant drawl, to inscribe the punctured thing for her own personal daddy, one Jolon Van Dyne of Shiny Prize, Kentucky. And she said also of the Dyne Riney Proton Donor Regent Corporation of nearby Boaz, Kentucky, and engaged him, Oren, in a slowly, decreasingly one-sided social function-type conversation. The PGOAT was pretty easy to stay in a one-to-one-like tete-a-tete with, since no other terrier could bring himself within 4 meters of her. And Oren gradually found himself almost meeting her eye as he shared that he believed it wasn't all athletic, hunting's pull for him, that a lot of it seemed emotional and or even, if there was such a thing anymore, spiritual. A denial of silence. Here were upwards of 30,000 voices, souls, voicing approval as one soul. He invoked the raw numbers, the frenzy. He was thinking out loud here. Audience exhortations and approvals so total, they ceased to be numerically distinct and melded into a sort of single coital moan. One big vowel, the sound of the womb, the roar gathering, tidal, amniotic, the voice of what might as well be God. None of Tennis's prim applause cut short by an umpire's patrician shush. He said he was just speculating here, ad-libbing. He was meeting her eye, and not drowning. His dread now transformed into whatever it had been dread of. He said the sound of all those souls as one sound, too loud to bear, building, waiting for his foot to release it. Oren said the thing he thought he liked was he literally could not hear himself think out there. Maybe a cliche, but out there, transformed. His own self transcended, as he'd never escaped himself, on the court. A sense of a presence in the sky. The crowd sound congregational, the stadium shaking climax as the ball climbed and inscribed a cathedral arc, seeming to take forever to fall. It never even occurred to him to ask her what sort of demeanor she preferred. He didn't have to strategize or even scheme. Later, he knew what the dread had been dread of. He hadn't had to promise her anything, it turned out. It was all for free. By the end of his freshman fall, and Boston University's championship of the Yankee Conference, plus its non-victorious but still unprecedented appearance at Las Vegas's dignitary-attended KLRMKI Forsythia Bowl, Oren had taken his off-campus housing subsidy and moved with Joel Van Dyne, the heart-stopping Kentuckian, into an East Cambridge co-op 3 subway stops distant from BU. And the all-new inconveniences of being publicly stellar at a major sport in a city where people beat each other to death in bars over stats and fealty. Joel had done the midnight Thanksgiving dinner at ETA and survived Avril. And then Oren spent his first Christmas ever away from home, flying to Paducah, and then driving a rented four-wheel drive to kudzu-hung Shiny Prize, Kentucky, to drink toddies under a little white reusable Christmas tree with all red balls, with Joelle and her mother and personal daddy and his loyal pointers, getting a storm cellar tour of Jolon's incredible Pyrex collection of every solution in the known world that can turn blue litmus paper red. Little red rectangles floating in the flasks for proof. Oren nodding a lot and trying incredibly hard, and Joel saying that Mr. Van Dees not once smiling at him was just his way, was all. The way his own mom's had her way, Joel had trouble with. Oren wired Marlon Bain and Ross Reet and the strabismic Nickerson that he was, by all indications, in love with somebody. Freshman New Year's Eve in Shiny Prize, far from the O-N-A-N-ite upheavals of the new Northeast, the last PM, before subsidization, was the first time Oren saw Joel ingest very small amounts of cocaine. Oren had exited his own substance phase about the time he discovered sex. Plus, of course, the N-O-N-A-N-C-A-A urine considerations, and he declined it, the cocaine, but not in a judgmental or killjoy way, and found he liked being with his P-G-O-A-T straight while she ingested. He found it exciting, a vicariously on-the-edge feeling he associated with giving yourself, not to any one game's definition, but to yourself, and how you unjudgmentally feel about somebody who's high and feeling even freer and better than normal, with you alone under the red balls. They were a natural match here. Her ingestion then was recreational, and he not only didn't mind, but never made a show of not minding, nor she that he abstained. The whole substance issue was natural and kind of free. Another reason they seemed star-fated was that Joelle had in her sophomore year decided to concentrate in film cartridge, academically, at BU, either film cartridge theory or film cartridge production, or maybe both. The PGOAT was a film fanatic, though her tastes were pretty corporate. She told O she preferred movies where a whole bunch of shit blows up.
101.
Oren, in a low-key way, introduced her to art film, conceptual and highbrow academic avant and après-garde film, and taught her how to use some of Interlace's more esoteric menus. He blasted up the hill to Enfield and brought down the Mad Stork's own prenuptial agreement of heaven and hell, which had a major impact on her. Right after Thanksgiving, himself let the PGOAT understudy with Leith on the set of The American Century as Seen Through a Brick, in return for getting to film her thumb against a plucked string. After an only mildly disappointing sophomore season, Oren flew with her to Toronto to watch part of the filming of Blood Sister, One Tough Nun. Himself would take Oren and his beloved out after dailies, entertaining Joelle with his freakish gift for Canadian cab hailing, while Oren stood, turtle-headed in his topcoat. And then later, Oren would shepherd the two of them back to their Ontario Place hotel, stopping the cab to let them both throw up, fireman carrying Joelle, while he watched the Mad Stork negotiate his suite by holding on to walls. Himself showed them the University of Toronto Conference Center, where he and the moms had first met. This might have been the end's start, gradually, in hindsight. Joelle that summer declined a sixth summer at the Dixie Baton Twirling Institute in Oxford, Mississippi, and let himself give her a stage name and use her in rapid succession in Low Temperature Civics, The Desire to Desire, and Safe Boating is No Accident, traveling with himself and Mario while Oren stayed in Boston, recuperating from minor surgery on a hypertrophied left quadriceps at a Massachusetts General Hospital, where no fewer than four nurses and PTs in the sports medicine wing filed for legal separation from their husbands with custody. The PGOAT's real ambitions weren't thespian, Oren knew, is one reason he hung in so long. Joelle, when he'd met her, already owned some modest personal film equipment, courtesy of her personal daddy, and she now had access to nothing if not serious digital gear. By Oren's sophomore year, she no longer twirled or incited pep in any way. In his first full season, she stood behind various white lines with a little Bolex R32 digital recorder and BTL meters and lenses, including a bitchin' ingenue zoom, Oren gone and paid for as a gesture, and she shot little half-disc sector clips of number 78, Boston University punter, sometimes with Leith in attendance, never himself, experimenting with speed and focal length and digital mats, extending herself technically. Oren, despite his interests in upgrading the PGOAT's commercial tastes, was himself pretty lukewarm on film and cartridges and theater and pretty much anything that reduced him to herd-like spectation. But he respected Joelle's own creative drives to an extent, And he found out that he really did like watching the football footage of Joel Van Dyne, featuring pretty much him only. Strongly preferred the little .5 sector clips to himself's cartridges or corporate films where things blew up while Joel bounced in her seat and pointed at the viewer. And he found them, her clips of him at play, way more engaging than the grainy, overcluttered game and play celluloids the head coach made everybody sit through. Oren liked to adjust the co-op's rheostat way down when Joel wasn't home, and haul out the diskettes and make Jiffy Pop and watch her little 10-second clips of him, over and over. He saw something different each time he rewound, something more. The clips of him punting unfolded like time-lapsing flowers and seemed to reveal him in ways he could never have engineered. He sat, rapt. It only happened when he watched them alone. Sometimes he got an erection. He never masturbated. Joel came home. Still in the last stages of a late puberty and the prettiness getting visibly worse day by day, Joel had been maiden still when Oren met her. She'd been shunned theretofore, both at Boston University and Shiny Prize Boaz Consolidated. The beauty had repelled every comer. She devoted her life to her twirling in amateur film. Disney Leith said she had the knack. Her camera hand was rock steady. Even the early clips from the start of the YW season looked shot off a tripod. There'd been no audio in the sophomore clips, and you could hear the high-pitched noise of the cartridge in the TP's disk drive. A cartridge revolving at a digital diskette's 450 RPM sounds a bit like a distant vacuum cleaner. Late-night car noises and sirens drifted in through the bars from as far away as the Starro 500. Silence was not part of what Oren was after, watching. Joel housekeeps like a fiend. The place is always sterile. The resemblance to the mom's housekeeping he finds a bit creepy. Except Joel doesn't mind a mess or give anybody the creeps worrying about hiding that she minds it, so nobody's feelings will be hurt. With Joel, the mess just disappears sometime during the night, and you wake up and the place is sterile. It's like elves. Soon after he started watching the clips in his junior year, Oren had blasted up Commonwealth's Hill and brought Joel back a Bolex-compatible Tatsuoka recorder with sync pulse, a cardioid mic, a low-end tripod with a Barney to muffle the Bolex's whir, a classy pillowtone blooper and sync pulse cords, a whole oracopia. It took Lee 3 weeks to teach her to use the pillowtone. Now, the clips had sound. Oren has trouble not burning the Jiffy Pop popcorn. It tends to burn as the foil top inflates. You have to take it off the stove before the foil forms a dome. No microwave popcorn for Oren, even then. He liked to dim the track lights when Joel was out, and haul out the cartridge rack and watch her little 10-second clips of his punts over and over. Here he is, back against Delaware, in the second home game of YTMP. The sky is dull and pale. The 5 Yankee Conference flags, University of Vermont and the University of New Hampshire, now history, are all right out straight with the gale off the Charles for which Nickerson Field is infamous. It's 4th down, obviously. Thousands of kilos of padded meat assume 4-point stances and chuff at each other, poised to charge and stave. Oren is 12 yards back from scrimmage, his cleated feet together, his weight just ahead of him, his mismatched arms out before him, and the attitude of the blind before walls. His eyes are fixed on the distant, grass-stained Valentine of the center's ass. His stance, waiting to receive the snap, is not unlike a diver's, he sees. 9 men on line, 4-pointed, poised to stave off 10 men's assault. The other team's deep back is back to receive, 70 yards away or more. The fullback, whose sole job is to keep Oren from harm, is ahead and to the left, bent at the knees, his taped fists together and elbows out like a winged thing ready to hurl itself at whatever breaches the line and comes at the punter. Joelle's equipment isn't quite pro caliber, but her technique is very good. By junior year, there's also color. There's only one sound, and it is utter. The crowd's noise and its response to that noise building. Oren's back against Delaware, ready, his helmet a bright non-contact white, and his head's insides scrubbed free for 10 seconds of every thought not connected to receiving the long snap and stepping martially forward to lob the leather egg beyond sight to an altitude that makes the wind no factor. Madam PGOAT gets it all, zooming in from the opposite end zone. She gets his timing. A punt's timing is minutely precise, like a serve's. It's like a solo dance. She gets the ungodly whoomp against and above the crowd's vowels climax.
She captures the pendular 180-degree arc of Oren's leg.
The gluteal follow-through that puts his cleat's laces way over his helmet. The perfect right angle between leg and turf. Her technique is superb on the Delaware debacle Oren can just barely take reviewing. The one time all year, the big chuffing center oversnaps and arcs the ball over Oren's upraised hands, so by the time he's run back and grabbed the crazy bouncing thing 10 yards farther back, the Delaware defense has breached the line, or through the line. The fullback supine and trampled. All 10 rushers rushing, wanting nothing more than personal physical contact with Oren and his leather egg. Joelle gets him sprinting, a 3-meter lateral burst as he avoids the first few sets of hands and the beefy curling lips, but is just about to get personally contacted and knocked out of his cleats by the Delaware strong safety flying in on a slant from way outside when the tiny 0.5 sector of digital space each punt's programmed to require runs out. And the crowd sound moves and dies, and you can hear the disk drive stalled at the terminal byte, and Oren's chin-strapped, plastic-barred face is there on the giant viewer, frozen and high-def in his helmet, right before impact, zoomed in on with a quality lens. Of particular interest are the eyes. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Poor Tony Krause had a seizure on the T. It happened on a Grey Line train from Watertown to Inman Square, Cambridge. He'd been drinking codeine cough syrup in the men's room of the Armenian Foundation Library in horrid central Watertown, Massachusetts, for over a week, darting out from cover only to beg a script from hideous Equus Reese, and then dash in at Brooks Pharmacy, wearing a simply vile ensemble of synthetic fiber slacks and suspenders and tweed Donegal cap he'd had to cage from a longshoreman's union haul. Poor Tony couldn't dare wear anything comely. Not even the Antetois brothers' red leather coat. Not since that poor woman's bag had turned out to have a heart inside. He had simply never felt so beset and overcome on all sides as the black July day when it fell to his lot to boost a heart. Who wouldn't wonder why me? He didn't dare dress expressive or ever go back to the square. And Emile still had him marked for demapping as a consequence of that horrid thing with Wu and Bobby C. last winter. Poor Tony didn't dare show one feather east of Tremont Street. Or at the Brighton Projects, or even Delfina's in Backwater Enfield since last Christmas, even after Emile simply dematerialized from the street scene. And now, since the 29th of July, he was non grata at Harvard Square and environs. And even the sight of an Oriental now gave him palpitations, say nothing of an Egner accessory. Thus, poor Tony had no way to cop for himself. He could trust no one enough to inject their wares. S.T. Cheese and Lola's sister were no more trustworthy than he himself. He didn't even want them to know where he slept. he began drinking cough syrup. He managed to get Bridget Tenderhall and the strictly rough-trade Stokely Darkstar to cop for him on the wink for a few weeks until Stokely died in a Fenway hospice, and then Bridget Tenderhall was shipped by her pimp to Bruckton under maddeningly vague circumstances. Then poor Tony had read the dark portents and swallowed the first of his pride and hid himself even more deeply in a dumpster complex behind the IBPWDW.
102.
Local, number 4 hall, in 4 Point downtown, and resolved to stay hidden there for as long as he could swallow the pride to send Lola's sister out to acquire heroin, accepting without pride or complaint the shameless rip-offs the miserable bitch perpetrated upon him. Until a period in October, when Lola's sister went down with hepatitis G, and the supply of heroin dried horribly up, and the only people even copping enough to chip were people in a position to dash here and there to great beastly lengths under an open public access sky, and no friend, no matter how dear or indebted, could afford to cop for another. Then, holy friend and connectionless, poor Tony, in hiding, began to withdraw from heroin. Not just get strung out or sick. Withdraw. The words echoed in his neuralgiac and wigless head, with a simple, most awful, sinister footsteps echoing in deserted corridor quality. Withdrawal. The wingless fowl. Turkeyfication. Kicking. The old cold bird. Poor Tony had never once had to withdraw. Not all the way down the deserted corridor of withdrawal, not since he first got strung at 17. At the very worst, someone kind had always found him charming if things got dire enough to have to rent out his charms. Alas, thus, about the fact that his charms were now at low ebb. He weighed 50 kilos, and his skin was the color of summer squash. He had terrible shivering attacks and also perspired. He had a sty that had scraped one eyeball as pink as a bunny's. His nose ran like twin spigots, and the output had a yellow-green tinge he didn't think looked promising at all. There was an uncomely dry-rot smell about him that even he could smell. In Watertown, he tried to pawn his fine auburn wig with removable chignon and was cursed at in Armenian because the wig had infestations from his own hair below. Let's not even mention the Armenian pawnbroker's critique of his red leather coat. Poor Tony got more and more ill as he further withdrew. His symptoms themselves developed symptoms. Troughs and nodes he charted with morbid attention in the dumpster, in his suspenders and horrid tweed cap, clutching a shopping bag with his wig and coat, and comely habiliments he could neither wear nor pawn. The empty Empire Displacement Company dumpster he was hiding in was new and apple green, and the inside was bare, dimpled iron. And it remained new and unutilized because persons declined to come near enough to utilize it. It took some time for poor Tony to realize why this was so. For a brief interval, it had seemed like a break, fortune's one wan smile. An EWD land barge cruise had him straight in language that left quite a bit of tact to be wished for, he felt. The dumpster's green iron cover also leaked when it rained, and it contained already a colony of ants along one wall, which insects poor Tony had ever since a neurasthenic childhood fear, and detested in particular, ants. And in direct sunlight, the quarters became a hellish living environment from which even the ants seemed to vanish. With each step further into the black corridor of actual withdrawal, poor Tony Kraus stamped his foot and simply refused to believe things could feel any worse. Then he stopped being able to anticipate when he needed to, as it were, visit the powder room. A fastidious gender dysphoric horror of incontinence could not properly be described. Fluids of varying consistency began to pour without advance notice from several openings. Then, of course, they stayed there, the fluids, on the summer dumpster's iron floor. They were there, not going anywhere. He had no way to clean up, and no way to cop. His entire set of interpersonal associations consisted of persons who did not care about him, plus persons who wished him harm. His own late obstetrician father had rended his own clothing in symbolic Shiva in the year of the Whopper in the kitchen of the Kraus home, 412 Mount Auburn Street, horrid central Watertown. It was the incontinence, plus the prospect of 11-4's monthly social assistance checks that drove poor Tony out for a mad, scampering relocation to an obscure Armenian Foundation Library men's room in Watertown Central, wherein he tried to arrange a stall as comfortingly as he could with shiny magazine photos and cherished knick-knacks and toilet paper laid down around the seat and flushed repeatedly, and tried to keep true withdrawal at some sort of bay with bottles of Codeine X Plus. A tiny percentage of codeine gets metabolized into good old C-17 morphine, affording an agonizing hint of what real relief from the bird might feel like. That is, the cough syrup did little more than draw the process out, extend the corridor. It slowed up time. Poor Tony Kraus sat on the insulated toilet in the domesticated stall all day and night, alternately swilling and gushing. He held his high heels up at 1900 hours when the library staff checked the stalls and turned off all the lights and left poor Tony in a darkness within darkness so utter he had no idea where his own limbs were or went. He left that stall maybe once every 2 days, scampering madly to Brooks in cast-off shades and a kind of hood or shawl made pathetically of brown men's room paper towels. Time began to take on new aspects for him now, as withdrawal progressed. Time began to pass with sharp edges. Its passage in the dark or dim-lit stall was like time was being carried by a procession of ants, a gleaming red martial column of those militaristic red southern U.S. ants that build hideous tall boiling hills. And each vile gleaming ant wanted a minuscule little portion of poor Tony's flesh in compensation as it helped bear time slowly forward down the corridor of true withdrawal. By the second week in the stall, time itself seemed the corridor, lightless at either end. After more time, time then ceased to move or be moved, or be move-throughable, and assumed a shape above and apart, a huge, musty-feathered, orange-eyed, wingless fowl, hunched, incontinent, atop the stall, with a kind of watchful but deeply uncaring personality that didn't seem keen on poor Tony Kraus as a person at all, or to wish him well, not one little bit. It spoke to him from atop the stall, the same things over and over. They were unrepeatable. Nothing in even poor Tony's grim life experience prepared him for the experience of time with a shape and an odor squatting. And the worsening physical symptoms were a spree at Bonwitz compared to time's black assurances that the symptoms were merely hints, signposts pointing up at a larger, far more dire set of withdrawal phenomena that hung just overhead by a string that unraveled steadily with the passage of time. It would not keep still and would not end. It changed shape and smell. It moved in and out of him like the very most feared prison shower assailant. Poor Tony had once had the hubris to fancy he'd had occasion really to shiver ever before. But he had never truly, really shivered until time's cadences, jagged and cold and smelling oddly of deodorant, entered his body via several openings. Cold, the way only damp cold is cold. The phrase he'd had the gall to have imagined he understood was the phrase, chilled to the bone. Shard-studded columns of chill entering to fill his bones with ground glass, and he could hear his joints' glassy crunch with every slightest shift of hunched position. Time, ambient, and in the air, and entering and exiting at will, coldly. And the pain of his breath against his teeth. Time came to him, with a falcon black of the library night, and an orange mohawk and merry widow, with tacky Amalfo pumps and nothing else. Time spread him, and entered him roughly, and had its way, and left him again in the form of endless, gushing liquid shit that he could not flush enough to keep up with. He spent the longest morbid time trying to fathom whence all the shit came from, when he was ingesting nothing at all but Codex Plus. Then at some point he realized, time had become the shit itself. Poor Tony had become an hourglass. Time moved through him now. He ceased to exist apart from its jagged-edged flow. He now weighed more like 45 kilograms. His legs were the size his comely arms had been before withdrawal. He was haunted by the word Zuckung, a foreign and possibly Yiddish word he did not recall ever before hearing. The word kept echoing in quick step cadence through his head without meaning anything. He'd naively assumed that going mad meant you were not aware of going mad. He'd naively pictured madmen as forever laughing. He kept seeing his sunless father again, removing the training wheels, looking at his pager, wearing a green gown and mask, pouring iced tea in a pebbled glass, tearing his sport shirt in filial woe, grabbing his shoulder, sinking to his knees, stiffening in a bronze casket, being lowered under the snow at Mount Auburn Cemetery, through dark glasses from a distance, chilled to the Zuckung. When, then, even the funds for the codeine syrup were exhausted, he still sat on the toilet of the rear stall of the AFL Lou, surrounded by previously comforting hung habiliments and fashion magazine photographs he'd fastened to the wall with tape caged on the way in from the reference desk, sat for almost a whole nother night and day, because he had no faith that he could stem the flow of diarrhea long enough to make it anywhere, if anywhere to go presented itself, in his only pair of gender-appropriate slacks. During hours of lit operation, the men's room was full of old men who wore identical brown loafers and spoke Slavic, and whose rapid-fire flatulence smelled of cabbage. Toward the end of the day of the second syrupless afternoon, the day of the seizure, poor Tony Krause began to withdraw from the cough syrups, alcohol, and codeine, and dimethylated morphine now, as well as from the original heroin, yielding a set of sensations for which not even his recent experience had prepared him. The alcohol withdrawal, especially. And when the true DT-type big-budget visuals commenced, when the first glossy and minutely hirsute army ant crawled up his arm and refused, ghost-like, to be brushed away or hammered dead, poor Tony threw his hygienic pride into Time's porcelain maw and pulled up his slacks, mortifyingly wrinkled from 10+ days puddled around his ankles, made what slight cosmetic repairs he could, donned his tacky hat with scotch-taped scarf of paper towels, and lit out in last-ditch desperation for Cambridge's Inman Square, for the sinister and duplicitous Antitois brothers, their glass entertainment and notions fronted operations center, he'd long ago vowed never again to darken the door of, and but now figured to be his place of very last resort. The Antitois, Canadians of the Quebec subgenus, sinister and duplicitous, but when it came down to it, rather hapless political insurgents, he twice availed of services through the offices of Lola Sister, now the only persons anywhere he could claim somehow owed him a kindness since the affair of the heart. In his coat and scally cap over scarf on Watertown Center's underground gray line platform, when the first hot, loose load fell out into the baggy slacks and down his leg and out around his high heel, he still had only his red high heels with the crossing straps, which the slacks were long enough to mostly hide. Poor Tony closed his eyes against the ants,
formicating up and down his arms, skinny length, and screamed a soundless interior scream of utter and soul-scalding woe. His beloved boa fit almost entirely in one breast pocket, where it stayed, in the name of discretion. On the crowded train itself, then, he discovered that he'd gone, in 3 weeks, from being a colorful and comely, albeit freakishly comely person, to being one of those loathsome urban specimens that respectable persons on T-trains slide and drift quietly away from, without even seeming to notice they're even there. His scarf of paper towels had come partly untaped. He smelled of bilirubin and yellow sweat, and wore week-old eyeliner that simply did not fly if one needed a shave. There had been some negative urine incidents as well in the slacks, to round matters out. He had simply never in his life felt so unattractive or been so sick. He wept silently in shame and pain at the passage of each brightly lit public second's edge. And the driver ants that boiled in his lap opened needle-teethed little insectile mouths to catch the tears. He could feel his erratic pulse in his sty. The gray line was of the green and orange line, trundling behemoth-type train, and he sat all alone at one end of the car, feeling each slow second take its cut. When it descended, the seizure felt less like a separate, distinct health crisis than simply the next exhibit in the corridor of horrors that was the old cold bird. In actual fact, the seizure, a kind of synaptic firefight in poor Tony's desiccated temporal lobes, was caused entirely by withdrawal not from heroin, but from plain old grain alcohol, which was Codonex Plus cough syrup's primary ingredient and balm. He'd consumed upwards of 16 little 80-proof bottles of Codonex per day for 8 days, and so was cruising for a real neurochemical bruising when he just up and stopped. The first thing that didn't augur very well was a shower of spark-sized phosphenes from the ceiling of the swaying train. This, plus the fiery violet aura around the heads of the respectables who'd quietly retreated as far as possible from the various puddles in which he sat. Their clean pink faces looked somehow stricken, each inside a hood of violet flame. Poor Tony didn't know that his silent whimpers had ceased to be silent, was why everyone in the car had gotten so terribly interested in the floor tiles between their feet. He knew only that the sudden and incongruous smell of Old Spice, stick deodorant, classic original scent, unbidden and unexplainable, his late obstetric papa's brand, not smelled for years, and the tiny panicked twitters with which withdrawal's ants skittered glossily up into his mouth and nose and disappeared, each, of course, taking its tiny pincered farewell bite as it went, augured some new and vivider exhibit on the corridor's horizon. He'd become, at puberty, violently allergic to the smell of Old Spice. As he soiled himself and the plastic seat and floor once again, the classic scent of times past intensified. Then, poor Tony's body began to swell. He watched his limbs become airy, white dirigibles, and felt them deny his authority and detach from him and float sluggishly up, snout first, into the steel mill sparks the ceiling rained. He suddenly felt nothing, or rather, nothing, a pre-tornadic stillness of zero sensation, as if he were the very space he occupied. Then, he had a seizure.
103.
The floor of the subway car became the ceiling of the subway car, and he was on his arched back in a waterfall of light, gagging on Old Spice and watching his tumid limbs tear ass around the car's interior like undone balloons. The booming zakung 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 was his high heels heels drumming on the soiled floor's tile. He heard a rushing train roar that was no train on earth and felt a vascular roaring rushing that, until the pain hit, seemed like the gathering of a kind of orgasm of the head. His head inflated hugely and creaked as it stretched, inflating. Then the pain,
Seizures hurt, is what few civilians have occasion to know, was the sharp end of a hammer. There was a squeak and a rush of release inside his skull, and something shot from him into the air. He saw Bobby C.C.'s blood misting upward in the hot wind of the Copley blower. His father knelt beside him on the ceiling in a well-rended, sleeveless tee, extolling the red socks of Rice and Lynn. Tony wore summer taffeta. His body flopped around without okay from HQ. He didn't feel one bit like a puppet. He thought of gaffed fish. The gown had 1,000 flounces and a saucy bodice of lace crochet. Then he saw his father, green-gowned and rubber-gloved, leaning to read the headlines off the skin of a fish a newspaper had wrapped. That had never happened. The largest print headline said, "Push." Poor Tony flopped and gasped and pushed down inside, and the utter red of the blood that feeds sight bloomed behind his fluttering lids. Time wasn't passing so much as kneeling beside him in a torn T-shirt disclosing the rodent-nosed tits of a man who disdains the care of his once comely bod. Poor Tony convulsed and drummed and gasped and fluttered.
A fountain of light all around him.
He felt a piece of nourishing and possibly even intoxicating meat in the back of his throat, but elected not to swallow it, but swallowed it anyway, and was immediately sorry he did. And when his father's bloody, rubbered fingers folded his teeth back to retrieve the tongue he'd swallowed, he refused absolutely to bite down ungratefully on the hand that was taking his food. Then, without authorization, he pushed and bit down and took the gloved fingers clean off.
So there was rubber-wrapped meat in his mouth again, and his father's head exploded into needled antennae of color like an exploding star between his gown's raised green arms and a call for Zuckung,
while Tony's heels drummed and struggled against the widening stirrups of light they were hoisted into, while a curtain of red was drawn wetly up over the floor he stared down at. Tony, and he heard someone yelling for someone to give in, with a hand on his lace belly as he bore down to push, and he saw the legs and the stirrups they held would keep spreading until they cracked him open and all the way inside out on the ceiling, and his last worry was that red-handed papa could see up his dress what was hidden. The 7th of November, Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Each of the 8 to 10 prorectors at the Enfield Tennis Academy teaches one academic class per term, usually a once-a-week Saturday thing. This is mostly for certification reasons. Plus, all but one of the prorectors are low-level touring professionals, with low-level professional tennis players, in general, being not exactly the most candid stars in the intellectual Orion.
104.
Because of all this, their classes tend to be not only electives, but academy jokes. And the ETA Dean of Academic Affairs regards prorector-taught classes, for example, in full YDAU, Corbett Thorpe's Deviant Geometries, Aubrey DeLint's Introduction to Athletic Spreadsheets, or the colon-mad Tex Watson's From Scarcity to Plenty, colon, From Putrid Stuff Out of the Ground to the Atom in the Mirror, colon, A Lay Look at Energy Resources from Anthracite to Annular Fusion, etc. as not satisfying any sort of quadrivial requirement. But the older ETAs, with more latitude, credit, and elective-wise, still tend to clamor and jostle for spots in the prorector seminars. Not just because the classes can be passed by pretty much anybody who shows up and displays vital signs, but because most of the prorectors are, also like low-level tennis pros, as a genus, kind of bats, and their classes are usually fascinating the way plane crash footage is fascinating. For example, although any closed room she's in soon develops a mysterious and overpowering vitamin B stink he can just barely stand, ETA senior Ted Schacht has taken Mary Esther Thode's perennially batsoid, the personal is the political is the psychopathological, the politics of contemporary psychopathological double binds All three times it's been offered.
Mary Esther Thode is regarded by the upperclassmen as probably insane, by, like, clinical standards, although her coaching proficiency with the girls' 16s is beyond dispute. A bit on the old side for an ETA pro-rector, Thode had been a pupil of Coach G. Stitt, back at Stitt's infamous Old Crop and Epaulette Harry Hopman program in Winter Park, Florida. And then for a couple years at the new ETA, as a top and showbound, if kind of rabidly political and not too tightly wrapped female junior. Later backlisted off both the Virginia Slims and Family Circle professional distaff circuits after trying to organize the circuit's more politically rabid and unwrapped players into a sort of radical post-feminist grange that would compete only in pro tournaments organized, subsidized, refereed, overseen, and even attended and cartridge distributed exclusively to not only women or homosexual women, but only by, for, and to registered members of the infamously unpopular early interdependence era female objectification prevention and protest phalanx.
105.
Given the shoe, she'd come, practically with a bandana tied over her shoulder, back to Coach Stitt, who, for historico-national reasons, has always had a soft place inside for anyone who seems even marginally politically repressed. Last spring's airless and bee-redolent section of Thode's psychopolitical offering, The Toothless Predator, Breastfeeding as Sexual Assault, had been one of the most disorientingly fascinating experiences of Ted Schacht's intellectual life so far, outside the dentist chair. Whereas this fall's focus on pathologic double-bind-type quandaries was turning out to be not quite as compelling, but weirdly, almost intuitively, easy. For example, from today's. The personal is the political, is the psychopathological. The politics of contemporary psychopathological double-binds midterm examination. Ms. Thode, November 7th. Year of DAU. Keep your answers brief and gender neutral. Item 1. 1A. You are an individual who is pathologically kleptomaniacal. As a kleptomaniac, you are pathologically driven to steal, steal, steal. You must steal. 1B. But you are also an individual who is pathologically agoraphobic. As an agoraphobic, you cannot so much as step off your front step of the porch of your home without undergoing palpitations, drenching sweats, and feelings of impending doom. As an agoraphobic, you are driven to pathologically stay home and not leave. You cannot leave home. 1C. But, from 1A, you are pathologically driven to go out and steal, steal, steal. But from 1B, you are pathologically driven to not ever leave home. You live alone. Meaning, there is no one else in your home to steal from. Meaning, you must go out into the marketplace to satisfy your overwhelming compulsion to steal, steal, steal. But such is your fear of the marketplace that you cannot, under any circumstances, leave home. Whether your problem is true personal psychopathology, or merely marginalization by a political definition of psychopathology, nevertheless, it is a double bind. 1D. Thus, respond to the question of, what do you do? Schacht was just looping the letter D in mail fraud when Jim Trolch's pseudo-radio program, backed by its Eustachian-crumpling operatic soundtrack, came over 112 West House's ETA intercom speaker up over the classroom clock. When no away tournaments or meets were going on, WETA student-run radio got to broadcast ETA-related news, sports, and community affairs for 10 or so minutes over the closed-circuit intercom every Tuesday and Sunday during the last PM class period, like 14:35 to 14:45 hours. Trolch, who's dreamed of a tennis broadcast career ever since it became clear, very early, that he would be in no way showbound,
The Trollchu spends every last fin his folks send him on his staggering interlace SPN Pro Match cartridge library, and spends almost every free second calling Pro Action with his room's TP viewer's volume down.
106.
The kind of pathetic Trollchu who shamelessly kiss-asses the interlace SPN sportscasters whenever he's on the scene of an ISPN-recorded junior event.
107.
Pestering the sportscasters and offering to get them donuts and Joe, etc. The Trollchu already owns a whole rack of generic blue blazers and practices combing his hair so that it has that glassy toupee-like look of a real sportscaster. Trollchu's been doing the sports portion of WETA's weekly broadcast ever since Schacht's old man died of ulcerative colitis, and Ted came up to join his old childhood doubles partner at the Academy in the fall of the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar, which had been 4 months after the late ETA headmaster's fellow de se, when the flags were still at half-mast and everybody's bicep was banded in black cotton, which the mesomorphic Schacht got excused from because of biceps size. Trollchu had already been doing WETA sports when he came, and he's been undislodgeable from the post ever since. The sports portion of WETA's broadcast is mostly just reporting the outcomes and scores of whatever competitive events the ETA squads have been in since the last broadcast.
108.
Trollchu, who approaches his twice-a-week duties with all possible verve, will say he feels like the hardest thing about his intercom broadcasts is keeping things from getting repetitive as he goes through long lists of who beat whom and by how much. His quest for synonyms for beat and got beat by is never-ending and serious and a continual source of irritation to his friends. Mary Esther's exams were notorious no-brainers, and automatic A's if you were careful with your third-person pronouns. And even while he listened closely enough to Trollchu to be able to supply the audience feedback that tonight's dinner table would be inescapable without, Schacht was already on the test's third item, which concerned exhibitionism among the pathologically shy. 11-7's broadcast results were from ETA's 71-37 rout of Port Washington's A and B teams at the Port Washington annual thing. John Wayne at A118s beat Port Washington's Bob Francis of Great Neck, New New York, 6-0-6-2, Trollchu says. While A2 singles, Howlin' Condensa defeated Craig Berta of Vivian Park, Utah, 6-2-6-1. And while A3, K.D. Coyle, went down in a hard-fought loss to Port Washington's Shelby Vandermeer of Hempstead, Long Island, 6-3-5-7-7-5. A4 Trevor, the Axe-Handle Axford, crushed PW's Tapio Marti out of Sonora, Mexico, 7-5-6-2. And so on. By the time it's down to boys A14s, Trollchu's delivery gets terser even as his attempts at verbiform variety tend to have gotten more lurid. For example, Lamanchu disemboweled Charles Pospisilova, 6-3-6-2. Jeff Penn was on Nate Millis Johnson like a duck on a June bug, 6-4-6-7-6-0. Peter Beek spread veal de lard on a cracker like some sort of hors d'oeuvre and bit down, 6-4-7-6. While 14's A4 Idris Arslanian ground his heel into the neck of David Weir, 6-1-6-4. And PW's five-man R. Greg Chubb had to be just about carried off over somebody's shoulder after Todd Postlethwaite moonballed him into a narcoleptic coma, 4-6-6-4-7-5. Some of Corbett Thorpe's class on geometric distortions a lot of kids find hard. Likewise, DeLint's class, for the software inept. And though Tex Watson's overall handle on cold containment, DT annulation, is shaky, his lay physics survey of combustion and annulation has some sort of academic validity to it, especially because he sometimes gets Pemulus to guest lecture when he and Pemulus are in a period of detente. But the only really challenging prorected class ever for Howlin' Condensa is turning out to be Mademoiselle Thierry Poutrincourt's Separatism and Return, Québécois History from Frontenac through the Age of Interdependence, which, to be candid, Hal had never heard much positive about and had always deflected his mom's suggestions that he might profitably take until finally this term's schedule juggling got dicey, and which, the class, he finds difficult and annoying, but surprisingly less and less dull as the semester wears on, and is actually developing something of a layman savvy for Canadianism and O-N-A-N-ite politics, topics he previously found for some reason not only dull but queerly distasteful. The rub of this particular class's difficulty is that Poutrincourt teaches only in Quebecois French, which Hal can get by in because of his youthful tour through Oren's real French Pléiade classics, but has never all that much liked, particularly sound-wise, Quebecois being a gurgly, glottal language that seems to require a perpetually sour facial expression to pronounce. Hal sees no way of Oren's knowing he was taking Poutrincourt's Separatism in Return when he called to ask for help with Separatism, which Oren's asking for help from him with anything was strange enough in itself. Bernadette Longley reluctantly bowed to PW's Jessica Pearlberg at 18A1 singles 6-4, 4-6, 6-2, although A2 Diane Prinz hopped up and down on the thorax of Port's Marilyn Nguyetep, 7-6, 6-1, and Bridget Boone drove a hot thin spike into the right eye of Amy Middleton Law, 6-3, 6-3. And so on, in classroom after classroom, while instructors grade quizzes, or read, or tap a decreasingly patient foot every Tuesday and Saturday, while Schacht sketches prenatal dentition charts in his exam's margins, with a concentrated look, not wanting to embarrass Thode by handing the no-brainer exam in too soon. Most of the early Quebec stuff about Cartier, and Roberval, and Cap Rouge, and Champlain, and flocks of Ursuline nuns with frozen wimples, covered up to like UN Day, Hald found mostly dry and repetitive. The wig and jerkin gentlemanly warfare stilted and absurd, like slow-motion slapstick, though everyone had been sort of queasily intrigued by the way the English commander Amherst had handled the Hurons by dispensing free blankets and buckskin that had been carefully coated with smallpox variola. 14's A3, Felicity Zweig, went absolutely sack-poop on PW's Kiki Pfefferblit, 7-6, 6-1, while Gretchen Holt made PW's Tammy Taylor Bing sorry her parents were ever even in the same room together, 6-0, 6-3. At 5, Anne Kittenplan grimaced and flexed her way to a 7-5, 2-6, 6-3 win over Paisley Steinkamp, right next to where Jolene Kreis at 6 was doing to PW's Mona Gett what a quality boot can do to a toadstool, 2-2. Saluki-faced Terry Poutrincourt leans back in her chair and closes her eyes and presses her palms hard against her temples, and stays like that all the way through every WETA broadcast, which always interrupts her last period lecture and puts this section slightly and maddeningly behind Separation and Return's other section, resulting in 2 required lesson preps instead of 1. The sour Saskatchewanese kid next to Hal has been making impressive schematic drawings of automatic weaponry in his notebook all semester. The kid's assigned ROM diskettes are always visible in his book bag, still in their wrapper. Yet, the sketch kid always finishes quizzes in like 5 minutes. It had taken up to the week before Halloween to get through the BS-67, Levesque Party and Bloc Québécois, and early Front de la Libération Nationale stuff, and up to the present interdependent era.
109.
Poutrincourt's lecture voice has gotten quieter and quieter as history's approached its contemporary limit. And Hal, finding the stuff rather more high concept and less dull than he'd expected, seeing himself as, at his innermost core, apolitical, nevertheless found the Québécois separatism mentality almost impossibly convolved and confused and impervious to U.S. parsing.
110.
Plus was both con and repelled by the fact that the contemporary anti-ONAN insurgent stuff provoked in him a queasy feeling, not the glittery disorientation of nightmares or on-court panic, but a soggier, more furtively nauseous kind of sense, as if someone had been reading mail of Hal's that he'd thought he'd thrown away. The proud and haughty Québécois had been harassing and even terrorizing the rest of Canada over the separation issue for time out of mind. It was the establishment of ONAN and the gerrymandering of the Great Convexity, Poutrincourt's Canadian, recall, that turned the malevolent attention of Québécois' worst post-FLN insurgents south of the border. Ontario and New Brunswick took the continental Anschluss and territorial reconfiguration like good sports. Certain far-right fringes in Alberta weren't too pleased, but not much pleases an Albertan far-rightist anyway. It was finally only the proud and haughty Québécois who whinged, and the insurgent cells of Quebec who completely lost their political shit.
111.
Quebec's anti-ONAN and thus U.S. separatist tours, the different terrorist cells formed when Ottawa had been the foe, proved to be not a very nice bunch at all. The earliest unignorable strikes involved a then-unknown terrorist cell,
112,
that apparently snuck down from the EWD-blighted Papineau region at night and dragged huge, standing mirrors across U.S. Interstate 87 at selected dangerous, narrow-winding Adirondack passes south of the border and its Lucite walls. Naively empiricist northbound U.S. motorists, a good many of them military and ONANite personnel this close to the concavity, would see impending headlights and believe, like some suicidal idiot or Canadian, had traversed the median and was coming right for them. They'd flash their high beams, but to all appearances the impending idiot would just flash his high beams right back. The U.S. motorists, usually not to be fucked with in their vehicles, historically, it was well known, would brazen it out as long as anyone right-minded possibly could. But right before apparent impact with the impending lights, they'd always veer wildly and leave shoulderless I-87 and put their arm over their head in that screaming pre-crash way and go ass over tea kettle into an Adirondack chasm with a many-petaled bloom of high-test flame. And the then-unknown Québécois terrorist cell would remove the huge mirror and truck off back up north via checkpointless backroads back into the blighted bowels of southern Quebec until next time. There were fatalities this way well into the year of the Tuck's medicated pad before anyone had any idea they were diabolic cell-related. For over 20 months, the scores of burnt-out hulls piling up in Adirondack chasms were regarded as either suicides or inexplicable, doze-behind-the-wheel-type single-car accidents by new New York State troopers who had to detach their chin straps to scratch under their big brown hats over the mysterious sleepiness that seemed to afflict Adirondack motorists at what looked to be high-adrenaline mountaintop passes. Chief of the new United States Office of Unspecified Services, Rodney Tyne, pressed, to his later embarrassment, for a series of anti-driving when drowsy public service spots to be interlaced disseminated in upstate New York. It was an actual U.S. would-be suicide, a late-stage Valium-addicted Amway distributor from Schenectady, who was at the end of her benzodioxane rope, and all over the road anyway, and who by historical accounts saw the sudden impending headlights in her northbound lane as grace, and shut her eyes and floored it right for them, the lights, never once veering, spraying glass and micronized silver all over four lanes. This unwitting civilian who smashed the illusion, made the breakthrough, these were media headlines, and brought to light the first tangible evidence of an anti-ONAN ill will, way worse than anything aroused by plain old historical separatism up in Quebec. The first birth of the Incandenza's second son was a surprise. The tall and eye-poppingly curvaceous Avril Incandenza did not show, bled like clockwork, no hemorrhoids or gland static, no pica, affect and appetite normal. She threw up some mornings, but who didn't in those days? It was on a metal-lit November evening in the seventh month of a hidden pregnancy that she stopped, Avril, on her husband's long arm As they ascended the maple staircase of the Back Bay brownstone, they were soon to leave, stopped, turned partly toward him, ashen, and opened her mouth in a mute way that was itself eloquent. Her husband looked down at her, paling. "What is it?"
"It's pain."
It was pain. Broken water had made several steps below them gleam. She seemed, to James and Cadenza, to sort of turn in toward herself, hold herself low, curl, and sink to a stair-step she barely made the edge of, hunched, her forehead against her shapely knees. And Cadenza saw the whole slow thing in a light like he was Vermeer. She sank steadily from his side, and he bent to hers, and she then tried to rise.
"Wait, wait, 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 wait.
It's pain."
A bit ragged from an afternoon of wild turkey and low-temperature holography, James had thought Averill was dying right before his eyes. His own father had dropped dead on a set of stairs. Luckily, Averill's half-brother Charles Tavis was upstairs, using the portable Stairmaster he'd brought with him for an extended and emotional battery-recharging visit the preceding spring, after the horrible snafu with the video scoreboard at Toronto Sky Dome. And he heard the commotion, and scuttled out and down, and promptly took charge. He had to be more or less scraped out, Mario, like the meat of an oyster, from a womb whose sides he'd been found spiderishly clinging, tiny and unobtrusive, attached by cords of sinew at both feet and a hand. The other fist stuck to his face by the same material.
113.
He was a complete surprise, and terribly premature, and withered, and he spent the next many weeks waggling his withered and contractured arms up at the Pyrex ceilings of his incubators, being fed by tubes and monitored by wires and cupped in sterile palms, his head cradled by a thumb. Mario had been given the name of Dr. James Incandenza's father's father, a dour and golf-addicted Green Valley, Arizona oculist who made a small fortune just after Jim grew up and fled east by inventing those, quote, X-ray specs that don't work, but whose allure for mid-60s pubescent comic book readers almost compelled mail order. Then selling the copyrights to New England novelty industry titan Acme Co. Then promptly, in mid-putt, died. Mario Sr. did, allowing James Incandenza Sr. to retire from a sad third career as the man from GLAD in sandwich bag commercials during the BS 1960s, and move back to the saguaro-studded desert he loathed, and efficiently drank himself to a cerebral hemorrhage on a Tucson stairway.
114.
Anyway, Mario II's incomplete gestation and arachnoidal birth left the kid with some lifelong character-building, physical challenges. Size was one. He being in sixth grade about the size of a toddler, and at 18-plus in a range somewhere between elf and jockey. There was the matter of the withered-looking and brady-auxetic arms, which, just as in a hair-raising case of Volkmann's contracture, curled out in front of his thorax in majuscule S's and were usable for rudimentary, knifeless eating and slapping at doorknobs until they sort of turned just enough and doors could be kicked open and forming a pretend lens frame to scout scenes through, plus maybe tossing tennis balls very short distances to players who wanted them, but not for much else, though the arms were impressively, almost familial dysautonomically, pain-resistant, and could be pinched, punctured, singed, and even compressed in a basement optical device-securing vice-like thing by Mario's older brother Oren, without effect or complaint.
115.
Brady pedestrianism-wise, Mario had not so much club feet as more like block feet, not only flat but perfectly square, good for kicking knob-fumbled doors open with, but too short to be conventionally employed as feet. Together with the lordosis in his lower spine, they forced Mario to move in the sort of lurchy half-stumble of a vaudeville inebriate, body tilted way forward as if into a wind, right on the edge of pitching face first onto the ground, which as a child he did fairly often, whether given a bit of a shove from behind by his older brother Oren or no. The frequent forward folds help explain why Mario's nose was squished severely in, and so flared out to either side of his face but did not rise from it, with the consequence that his nostrils tended to flap just a bit, particularly during sleep. One eyelid hung lower than the other over his open eyes, good and gently brown eyes, if a bit large and protrusive, to qualify as conventionally human eyes. The one lid hung like an ill-tempered window shade, and his older brother, Orin, had sometimes tried to give the recalcitrant lid that smart type of downward snap that can unstick a dicky shade, but had succeeded only in gradually loosening the lid from its sutures, so that it eventually had to be refashioned and reattached in yet another blepharoplasty procedure. Because it was in fact not Mario's real eyelid. That had been sacrificed when the fist stuck to his face like a tongue to cold metal had been peeled away at nativity. But an extremely advanced blepharoprosthesis of dermal fibropolymer studded with horsehair lashes that curved out into space well beyond the reach of his other lid's lashes, and together with the lazy lid action itself gave even Mario's most neutral expression the character of an oddly friendly pirate's squint, together with the involuntary constant smile. This is probably also the place to mention Hal's older brother Mario's khaki-colored skin, an odd dead gray-green that in its corticate texture, and together with his atrophic, incurled arms and arachnodactylism gave him, particularly from a middle distance, an almost uncannily reptilian dinosaurian look. The fingers being not only mucronate and talonesque, but non-prehensile, which is what made Mario's knife work untenable at table. Plus, the thin, lank, slack hair, at once tattered and somehow too smooth, that looked at 18-plus like the hair of a short, plump, 48-year-old stress engineer and athletic director and academy headmaster, who grows one side to girlish length and carefully combs it so it rides thinly up and over the gleaming yarmulke of bare, gray-green, complected scalp on top and down over the other side where it hangs, lank, and fools no one, and tends to flap back up over in any wind Charles Tavis forgets to carefully keep his left side to. Or that he's slow, Hal's brother is, technically, Stanford Binet-wise slow, the Brandeis CDC found. But not, verifiably not, retarded, or cognitively damaged, or bradyphrenic. More like refracted, almost. Ever so slightly epistemologically bent. A pole poked into mental water, and just a little off, and just taking a little bit longer in the manner of all refracted things. Or that his status at the Enfield Tennis Academy, erected, along with Dr. and Mrs. I's marriage's third and final home at the northern rear of the grounds, when Mario was 9, and Hallie 8, and Orin 17, and in his one ETA year B4 singles, and in the USTA's top 75, that Mario's life there is by all appearances kind of a sad and left-out type existence. The only physically challenged minor in residence, unable even to grip a regulation stick, or stand unaided behind a boundaried space. That he and his late father had been, no pun intended, inseparable. That Mario'd been like an honorary assistant production assistant, and carried the late Incandenza's film and lenses and filters in a complex backpack the size of a joint of beef for most of the last 3 years of the late blooming filmmaker's life, attending him on shoots and sleeping with multiple pillows in small, soft, available spaces in the same motel rooms as himself, and occasionally tottering out for a bright red plastic bottle of something called Big Red Soda Water, and taking it to the apparently mute, veiled graduate intern down the motel's hall, fetching coffee and Joe and various pancreatitis remedies and odds and ends for props, and helping D-Leith out with continuity when Incandenza wanted to preserve continuity. Basically being the way any son would be whose dad let him into his heart's final and best-loved love. Lurching game.